Hey guys, Peyton here with a quick note before we get started. If you're like me, the pandemic has not been great for your mental health. I've been dealing with depression for most of my life, and when I'm in a depressive episode, one of the hardest things, bar none, is eating. Like getting enough to eat, period, but also mustering up the energy to eat and plan nutritious meals and go grocery shopping and cook and do all the dishes. I just can't cook when I'm depressed. Have you ever been on that depression meals subreddit where people like post meals they make when they're depressed? Let me look at some recent posts. White bread with butter and everything bagel seasoning, chocolate syrup over white rice, a Pop-Tart I crushed up and ate like cereal. And there are times when you can't even manage that, so you cave and order fast food takeout and it's not good for you and it adds up. It's hard out here, and one thing that has made it so much easier for me is WeCook. WeCook is not a meal kit service. WeCook does the cooking for you. All you do is log in once a week, choose from a menu of delicious, nutritious, genuinely healthy meal options, and WeCook will deliver all your meals to your door in refrigerated, recyclable packaging. I'm looking at this week's menu now, and I'm seeing shrimp pad thai, falafel, vegetarian paella, smoked salmon, a quinoa salad with spicy peanut dressing. It all sounds a lot better than chocolate syrup over white rice, and a lot healthier than fast food. It's also a lot cheaper than fast food. With WeCook, I pay $11.75 per meal. There are options for every budget and every diet, and when you sign up at WeCookMeals.ca with the promo code JoesBoys70, you can get $70 off your first two orders. That's WeCookMeals.ca with the code JoesBoys70. WeCook delivers all throughout Ontario or Quebec, so if you live in Toronto, Montreal, anywhere in either province, head on over to WeCookMeals.ca to sign up now. And back to your regularly scheduled Little Women programming. Hello and welcome to Joe's Boys. This is a podcast for little women, little men, and everyone in between. I'm your host, Peyton Thomas. I'm the author of the novel Both Sides Now, and I'm also a writer for publications like Pitchfork, Billboard, and Vanity Fair. I'm here today with my very special guest, Andy Schwartz. Hi, Andy.
Hello.
Hello. Andy is a visiting scholar at the School of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at York University. Her dissertation was an online ethnography of femme internet culture. Her writing has appeared in Social Media and Society, Psychology and Sexuality, First Monday, Feral Feminisms, and a whole bunch of other places. She's also a blog editor for Shameless Magazine here in Toronto. Welcome, Andy. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling so good. Thank you. I'm so excited to be on this podcast. So thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, I'm so glad. You're a friend of the pod, Morgan, who recommended you. And I have read the chapter that you wrote about Carly Rae Jepsen with her. which was a real highlight. I should tell you, a Carly Rae Jepsen fan from the first Canadian Idol audition.
Oh, wow.
We go way back. So
I'm not even that big of a fan. Yeah, you can miss me with that tug of war stuff, but I'm here for the rest of it. But I know Morgan is right there with you. I'm pretty sure that Morgan was in the audience for the...
No way.
Yeah. Yeah. You should ask her about it.
Okay. Yeah. Morgan, ground floor, day one.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly.
Well, so you're a femme, you're a Scorpio. Now we need to know, which March sister are you? And Lori is a March sister for the purposes of this podcast.
I definitely strongly identify with Joe. I always have, but I also strongly identify with Beth. So,
okay.
So I have both sides in me. Mm-hmm. I actually have the first copy of Little Women that I ever read was like an abridged illustrated children's version. And so I have taken that book to a tattoo artist and got them to, like, I have a big portrait of Joe March. Yeah. Tattooed on my thigh, like Joe, like at her desk with like Scrabble the Ratter. Always really identified with Joe, her temper, her writing, rough and tumble, all very identifiable. But then Beth, I also am so shy and love staying home. It's the water sign.
Yes.
So yeah. Who are you?
I'm definitely Joe. I have created an entire podcast around Joe. Like you, I grew up reading Little Women, but it wasn't until the Greta Gerwig movie and the adaptation and the way that I really saw Greta make room for Joe's gender stuff. Mm-hmm. And until I kind of dug more into Louisa May Alcott's history and her legacy that I kind of
came to understand Little Women as really a trans text. And there's a lot of love in my heart for Joe and for Lou Alcott and kind of the primordial understanding of not being able to get over one's disappointment in not being a boy, or feeling as though, as Lou Alcott said, being more than half persuaded that I am, by some freak of nature, a man's soul in a woman's body, which is it's a mood, and I'm a trans guy. So I've come at it from that angle in a lot of my research. Joe to Joe communication with us here today. Yeah.
Very Joe excited. For Joe.
Joe for Joe. Yeah. It's a new dating app category. What's your relationship to Little Women? Did you grow up with it? Have you studied it, written about it, anything like that?
I was under 10 for sure when I first read it. It's probably in my most read book, and I think therefore my favorite. I won't say I read it every single year, but like most years, like as soon as that winter break hits, it's Little Women time. Christmas just isn't Christmas without any presents. I need it in December. So I love it. I have this hardcover children's version that the pages are yellowed. It's been with me through all four cities I've lived in, every apartment. Wow. All this stuff, taking it to the tattoo parlor to get that. And I also had another copy that the cover wore off, and I had to scotch tape it together because I read it so much. That's like the first whole story that I got, you know, because the abridged one left out. I'm not sure exactly, but it made it shorter.
Yeah, for sure.
And more age appropriate, although it's a pretty wholesome story. But and then a few years ago, my friend bought me like a really pretty hardcover copy that has like scissors, like different pairs of scissors all over the cover, and there's like a ribbon bookmark. That's my current
lovely
copy.
Yes.
Yeah. So I am a fan. I'm a collector. Yes. I see a really pretty cover, like a new edition I haven't seen. I want it. So I'm a big fan. And I actually just saw the Greta Gerwig movie version for the first time this past winter. Like, I think I watched it on Christmas Day. Yeah. Because I don't know how, I just kept missing it. And I didn't like the 90s movie at all.
Okay. We'll circle back to that. Yes.
Yeah. You know, I'm just one of those, like, the book was better people. Sure. And I think because I'm so attached to this book and how I've imagined the character, someone else doing it, I'm like, ugh, stop. Yeah. But all of that being said, I love the 2019 film. And it actually like made me see Amy in a bit of a different light. Like, I really love what they did with Amy in the movie.
I was saying to Morgan, what Florence Pugh did for Amy in that movie is like when a mom lifts a car off a baby, like just like a feat of like superhuman strength.
Yeah. I have so much more appreciation. I think she actually really gave the character more depth than even we see in the book. So quite delighted by it.
Today we're here talking about chapter 8, Joe Meets Apollyon, which is one of those references to Pilgrim's Progress, which I have not read, and I assume you haven't read it either. No. Did you like grow up evangelical by any chance? Or
I was raised Presbyterian, but like I think it kind of fell away pretty early, maybe around age 10 or 11.
My only knowledge of Pilgrim's Progress was an evangelical vacation Bible school I went to as a kid, where the camp counselors acted out Pilgrim's Progress. And I remember we just had a ball with that.
Oh, yeah.
But I have no recollection of it beyond that. So
yeah, you know what? Vacation Bible school was awesome. I used to go all the time. It was so fun.
It could be quite popping.
I had a lot of good fun.
Yes. Would you like to recap for us what happens in Joe Meets Apollyon?
Okay, so I think of this chapter as a lot of temper happening. So basically, Joe is going out with Meg and Lori. They're going to go see some cultural thing, like maybe they're going to the theater or something. And Amy wants to come, and Joe is saying, no, you can't come. And Amy's like, but like, you promised last time that I could come next time. And it's like, totally next time, please let me come. And Joe's like, you know what, you're a brat and like, you're bothering me. I think she says something pretty snarky.
Yes.
So they just leave. As they are doing so, I'm pretty sure Amy says, you'll regret this, Joe March. Yeah?
Yes.
Anyways, so Joe is like, not bothered, goes out with her friends, has a nice time, comes home, goes to find her manuscript to continue with her really important work, and she cannot find it. Mm-hmm. It turns out Amy, in a fit of rage and revenge, has burnt the manuscript. And it's so devastating. Joe's been working on this story for like probably, I don't even know, however long, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's a time of pen and paper, you know, there's no backup.
Yes.
How is it? So Jo is like pretty sure she's like, I'll never forgive you. I think, does she shake her? She gives Amy a good shake.
She shakes Amy so hard that her teeth rattle in her skull, it says, which is
Yeah, I remember that detail. I was like, oh man, that's a hard shake. Yeah. Stuck with me. So anyways, the whole family is like, yeah, Jo, this is like so terrible. Amy is super bad, but you should probably try to forgive her. And Jo's like, yeah, right. Not going to do it. No chance. So then like we kind of cut to another part where she's going out with Lori again. They're going to go skate on the local river pond situation. And again, Amy's like, I want to come and you keep leaving me out. Like, you got to let me come this time. Jo was like, I'm still furious about you because you've ruined my life. Jo and Lori start skating and Amy's following them. I'm pretty sure at the encouragement of Meg, who's just like, you should go. She'll forgive you if you go. So Amy's skating, trying to catch up with them. And she doesn't hear that Lori's like, oh, the ice is really soft in the middle, so stay close to the edge. Mm-hmm. And Jo knows that Amy didn't hear her say that. So anyways, she keeps skating. So Amy skates into the middle of the river or the pond or whatever, where the ice is really thin, and she falls in and they have to rescue her. It's very bad and very scary. So as Amy is recovering, napping in front of the fire, Jo and her mom have this heart to heart about like, oh my God, my temper is out of control. What's wrong with me? I'm so horrible. And then Marmee is like, same. I have the same temper. Anyways, and they have this really beautiful conversation about taming your temper and just trying to do a little bit better, and very wholesome and sweet. And they make up in the end because Jo realizes, okay, setting my sister up to drown because she ruined my book was like, it was almost fair, but not fair ultimately.
I am mad at Amy, but not mad enough to kill her. There's a lot.
Yeah. I felt bad about that in the end.
Yes.
I wanted to see how it felt. I'll try it, but ultimately it was like, not for me.
Not for me. No. And Jo's serial killer chapter comes to us an early close. There's a lot in this chapter about anger, a lot here about women's anger and girls' anger. And I'm very excited to have you, a self-described acaphemic here, to dig into that with us, because I feel like a lot was made of, especially the line where Marmee says, I'm angry nearly every day of my life. People didn't realize that Greta took that from the book verbatim. They were surprised by that. So I'm very excited. Let's start at the very beginning here, where Jo and Lori are getting ready to go out to the theater with Meg and John Brooke on kind of a double date situation, but
approaching.
Yeah, I'm very invested in the Jo and Lori relationship. And it's difficult because on the one hand, you have the straight people who are like, they're soulmates. And and I'm not in that camp at all. I want to be very clear. But one of the excuses that Jo gives for why Amy can't come along to the theater is, you can't sit with us, for our seats are reserved and you mustn't sit alone. So Lori will give you his place and that will spoil our pleasure. So it's very like, you're horning in on my time with my friend. What do you make of that? What do you make of that?
When I was first reading this book, when I was a kid, I was like, for sure, right. Jo and Lori belong together. Absolutely. Yes. 100%. But then now I'm like, no, that would like, now I see where Jo's coming from. I'm like, no, absolutely not. So it is a bit of a journey. Maybe if you've only read it one time, you feel that way. I don't know. Jo is really, really protective of Lori, which is so interesting. She's really protective of that friendship. And I think maybe that's what makes it confusing for people. Where they're like, but why didn't you marry him or whatever? Yeah. But it's just that it's not that kind of love, you know? Her and Lori get up to the best stuff. Being with Lori offers her such freedom that she just doesn't have if she's chaperoning her little sister. I totally get that, wanting to protect that pleasure. Yes.
In the Greta Gerwig movie, Florence Pugh is cast and Florence Pugh is an adult woman, and which leads to some very funny scenes, like she's at school surrounded by 9-year-olds and Greta's like, just go with it.
Make it work.
But then in the 94 version, which you've already said you don't care for, in the first half of the movie, Kirsten Dunst is playing her. And Kirsten Dunst is a child. Winona Ryder is kind of a young, early 20s, but Kirsten Dunst is 8 or 9. That creates such an interesting difference in this subsequent burning of the manuscript section, right? Kirsten Dunst is 8 years old, lighting the manuscript on fire, comes off as mischievous kid sister behavior, not really fully understanding the consequences, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then when Florence Pugh does it, it's like horror movie villain.
Oh, yeah.
Her face lighting up orange. What do you think of that contrast in those scenes?
I think it was really the Greta Gerwig's adaptation of the story into the film that really made me see Amy differently. And yeah. I think it makes Amy generally way more femme and way more camp than she was in the book or in the 90s version. So I think of Jenny Fran Davis is this writer who wrote the essay High Femme Camp Antics. And it is like so that for me, where it's like, if you know, we are envisioning Joe as like a butch character, Amy, especially in this particular performance of it, is exacting her revenge in this really particular, I'm going to do something so over the top that you will hate yourself almost as much as you hate me somehow. I'll just turn it into like this really confusing emotional thing. So I just love that they did this for Amy. Yeah, it's interesting. It makes it so camp. Almost because it's so inappropriate. It's such an inappropriate thing for an adult woman to be doing. So when you're looking at it, I'm confused. But it's like you said, it's like when it's Kirsten Dunst with her like friggin' ringlets or whatever, you're like, kids are very bad. But it's like when it's happening in this version, you're like, oh, she's just. So it's not camp, but it's approaching this high femme camp antics thing that Jenny Fran Davis, which she gives so many examples of through different films of just doing the most. One of the things she talks about is the Amelia Bedelia Ditz trick, where you just like pretend not to know how to do something so that like you can make your butch feel strong. It's just like being manipulative, basically. It's a really, really good essay.
I love that essay when it came out, and I love the application of it to Amy in particular. I was able to read May Alcott's diaries. I was doing some archival research last year, and May Alcott, she was high femme camp antics every day of her life. I cannot emphasize enough. This is the inspiration for the real life Amy, by the way, I should add. There's this one glorious stretch in her journals where she's out on a seaside vacation with a bunch of her friends, flirting with every single boy. Mm-hmm. There's a boy who sings a song to her around a campfire one night, and she likes it so much she makes him sing it to her three more times, just like on a loop, like she like it's an iPod, right? There's a part where she's reflecting on Lou just got a book deal, that's so exciting, she's so talented, I wish I had talent for anything but flirting. She has this incredible concept of herself as just this bright feminine sparkly force moving through the world. And I think having read May's journals and having a greater understanding of her and her work, she became a very accomplished artist and sculptor in her own right. She was the sculpting teacher of the guy who sculpted the Lincoln Memorial. She made her mark on the world.
Oh, wow,
and
yeah.
It's kind of hard not to see the character of Amy as kind of a hatchet job on May.
Siblings, right?
Siblings, right. Yeah. And I think what's interesting here, Greta really pulls this out, but it's there in the text. Joe and Amy had many lively skirmishes. We love a skirmish in the course of their lives, for both had quick tempers and were apt to be violent when fairly roused. Amy teased Joe and Joe irritated Amy, and semi-occasional explosions occurred, of which both were much ashamed afterward. So I think there's this understanding of kind of Joe and Amy as two sides of the same coin, where if Joe's expression is more butch antics, then... then Amy is definitely high femme camp antics.
I think it's really interesting. And I think that context of the, you know, May Alcott's diaries is really, really interesting too. Yeah. And I honestly see them both doing this thing, and it's anger, how anger plays out in this chapter. They both are doing so much. It's like unreasonable, escalated to match even more unreasonable. Honestly, burning that manuscript is devastating. I would not have recovered, you know, and she does.
No,
like not right away. But then also setting it up. So maybe she'll fall in the ice. Maybe I won't care. I really hesitate to call Joe a femme in any way, but you know, it's approaching that. Two sides of the same coin. Yeah. Manipulating each other to exact your revenge to get what you want and doing all of this. I even think, and I don't want to stray from my chapter, but even the church bazaar or whatever, Amy's table.
Yes.
You know, like she just, her table gets overshadowed. And so she just makes it even more beautiful and steals the show, basically, because she's like, oh, now I'm at the back. The book is very moral and it makes her like a little more demure. But, you know, underneath that and the limes, as also in the movie, it's so funny where she's like, he struck me, and she's just like really hamming it up, right?
Yeah.
And like, I agree. Corporal punishment is absolutely, there's no place for it, but like just the way that she works a room.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. There were very little editorial oversight on Little Women that I found. I was able to look at some original manuscript pages. I don't know if this is just the way publishing worked, but it seems like Lou pretty much sent the pages in and they just printed it, maybe proofread a few things. So there wasn't much in the way of editorial oversight. There's a common misconception that in the context of the high femme camp antics that we're talking about. When Amy goes abroad and is touring through Europe, initially she has way more than just the one suitor. Like she is flirting with everyone and writing home to her mom about how many guys she's flirting with. And all of that gets removed. Anne Boyd Rieu wrote and annotated this annotated edition of Little Women that I have here. And her read on that situation is that it was sort of a slut-shaming move about Amy. Amy wasn't allowed to have too many boyfriends or be too popular. May Alcott said, I have a talent. I have a God-given talent for flirting. I will flirt with anyone.
Yeah.
I liked when you sang me that song. Could you sing it three more times? Like, so some of this is getting pressed out of Amy as well. You mentioned the book is making her more demure. So like, what do you think is the moral lesson for Amy in this chapter?
Oh yeah, it's so complicated, right? Because it's like, she, especially this pressure, I think it's like, it's very real in the time that marrying well is honestly, it's really important for these girls, for these little women. Aunt March really lays down the law for Amy. She's like, it's your job. Your sister married this poor teacher. Joe is probably not going to get married. And Beth's dead. Okay. Like, you've got to do something. Or Beth's dying. So I think that Amy takes that to heart and is part of this casting this wide net with her flirting. It's, yeah, she takes it really seriously. Like, she takes it seriously that she wants to have a nice life. She's like, I got to provide for my poor, righteous little family, their strong beliefs. She's like, I got to be the one who throw that all away so that we can eat and stuff. And again, I think it's in the Greta Gerwig film that comes across really clearly. And I think that's part of the high femme camp antics, because then you can sort of, you see how calculated it is. But the moral lesson for Amy, she's really ambitious, but she also can see herself very clearly. She's like, I'm just, what am I going to do otherwise? Yes. Not a genius. So I'll just endow the arts or whatever. Yeah. So I think Amy through the course of the book is the spoiled one. She's bratty. And so she kind of, I think that's a hard lesson for her. It's like, she's not going to get everything she wants. She is Laurie's second choice. That's a hard life to live, you know, like, and then, you know, you're not going to be the artist you always wanted to be. So it's like, she has to eat a lot of humble pie, really. But she does get in that kind of constrained understanding the best life out of any of them. Yeah. She marries the richest.
I want to get into the Amy-Laurie relationship, actually. I'm really glad you brought that up, and kind of this thing of Amy being the second choice, Amy not really realizing her aspirations so much, right? It's more in the book than any of the films, because the films understandably focus on the sisters, right? But there's kind of a whole Laurie soliloquy where he goes and tries to make it as an opera composer and just never really gets off the ground. So by the time he comes back into Amy's life, he's sort of a failed composer. She's a failed artist. And that's where they meet one another. So it's this kind of, they're meeting each other in kind of this common ground. I said earlier, for the purposes of this podcast, Laurie is a March sister. And I really, I'm very interested in the possibility of trans femme Laurie. I think Laurie is really the only example we have in literature of a male character looking in on a world of women and really, really wanting to be a part of that world, right? To the point where the marrying Amy is kind of, I just really want to be a part of your family and be an honorary March sister. And Beth is dead. So
can we this is the situation. Yeah, it is giving a little end of the night, lights go on in the bar, who's still there, you know? Like, it's a little bit that.
Do you think they're well suited for one another? And do you see any kind of seeds of that future relationship in this chapter?
Yeah, you know, I guess like when I was reading the book, every single time I was reading the book, Laurie and Amy getting together in the end, it's every time it's a surprise. It's like, oh yeah, what? Yes.
Yeah.
But I guess here it's like, we could maybe sort of interpret, I would always interpret it Amy's like strong desire to go out with, she just wanted to be like with Joe and she just wanted to be with her sisters. Yeah, but maybe it's also like, she is always in like in a hurry to grow up. And I think maybe you can sort of see the seeds of this, like a crush on Laurie just being like super ready to be like, I want to go out on the town. am. I want to live that life. So it's like, maybe if I'm thinking a little more carefully about it, I can see it. Okay. So maybe there's some interest in Lori here, because her and Joe hanging here also doesn't make any sense. Like, why would you want to go skiing with Joe? Just push you through the ice. You should have seen that coming. Honestly, it can't be the first time. Yeah. I think you raise an interesting point that they're kind of both failed artists and they kind of meet each other where they're they can see, they can be like really honest with each other, I think, is the thing that comes out.
I think there's a mutual understanding of their situation. This is not the faded from day one love match. It's it grows into that. And I don't know if you've read any of the sequels, like Little Men or Joe's Boys. I haven't either. I dipped into them, but Lou Alcott was so weird, man. Like, the future she imagines for these characters is just like, okay, so Joe is here and she's running a school, and Lori is on the same plot of land running a college, and they all live together in this commune, and Joe and Lori are still best friends. Even though they live there with their respective spouses, they're always together. They have fun little nicknames for each other.
Yeah. I did read Little Men, but I don't remember it that clearly. Yeah. I don't think, or maybe it was Joe's Boys. No, I don't think so. Anyways, I did read one of them, but I think that's, it is like, that's the vision. And I think they kind of all believed in that vision, right? Like, they think that's exactly why they just all wanted to be together. It's so interesting. This is a bit of a tangent. It's so different than how we understand community now, even though it's like Joe and Amy, clearly they do not get along. And then everyone's heart is broken in some way or another, but they're like, you know what, but this is it. Like, we're the community. This is our family. Yes. We're not rebuilding it. We're just going to make it work. It's so interesting. It's such a, I wouldn't do that now. You know what I mean? We don't get along. I'm not going to force it. But, and I think that's sort of the idealism of the story too. It's like really beautiful.
I think a lot of what Lou was expressing with the relationship between Joe and Lori was kind of trying to have this relationship, a really, really close comradeship unbound from gender, where there was no romantic or sexual pressure. Getting into Louisa May Alcott's biography here, there was a point when she was a young child and her dad was on this mission to found a vegan commune, which is a whole thing, and we don't have to get into all that, but at one point he visited a Shaker community which was segregated by gender and came back to his own commune and said that this is great, we should segregate by gender. And he had a wife and four daughters. And I think, so it would essentially mean breaking the family up. And Lou was devastated that this was even suggested. And it came at, the vegan commune was failing. Her father, as it was failing, was having this bout of suicidality. So this threat of having to live segregated by gender, especially with Lou, even at that age, knowing I don't feel like a girl, I feel like a boy. Mm-hmm. I think that just might've been devastating. And I think so much of the Joe and Lori relationship is just trying to get to a place where that kind of community can exist without division along those gendered lines. Going back to the nascent Lori and Amy relationship here, I think it's noteworthy that when Joe was saying, this is why you can't sit with us, Amy, she said, Lori would have to give up his seat. So she's even then setting up, if you do get to go, just know you don't get to sit with Lori. Okay, like, I am not going to give up my seat so you can sit with Lori. She's just foregrounding, trying to avoid Amy and Lori even getting close in that way, because Lori holds something so special for Joe.
Yeah, I think I really agree. And as much as Joe doesn't want to be with Lori in that way, she doesn't want to lose like anything to compromise their closeness, right? So even Amy getting in there is a potential threat, because it's the place where Joe is the most free, where she's honestly the most accepted, because obviously her sisters and her mom love her, but they're like, oh, you know, you should act like a lady. Not all of them. Beth loves her. She thinks she's perfect.
Yes.
Beth is perfect. But in those moments, she doesn't want to share Lori. I think that's also why, as a reader, I never could consider that Lori might be interested in Amy, because Joe is so in there, ready just to keep everybody separate. Like, she wants, it's odd, right? She wants everyone to be together and never, no one to move out and get married and all that stuff.
Yeah,
there's a lot of tension, a lot of tension in there.
Yeah, and it's noteworthy. This is also in the Gerwig film, at least. This is the same moment where Lori hints, oh, Meg and John Brooke are getting pretty close. And Joe is really disturbed by that. She doesn't want that romantic closeness getting in the way either, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, no one can be straight.
Yeah. It's kind of like a Peter Pan sort of situation, right? It's like, no one grow up, because then like the party's over. We have to do all of this straight stuff. We have to then go and get married, and we can't play anymore. You just have to work. Yeah. And that's that's very real.
Joe doesn't want to be a woman, period, but she especially doesn't want to be a wife in the traditional sense.
Oh yeah.
Some of the extreme not wanting Meg to get married not wanting Amy and Lori to get close is I don't want that for any of you either.
Yeah. And yeah. Once Meg's gone, Joe's next, yeah. You know, it's just, yeah. These are exposed. It's sort of like, I don't know. Did you watch Bridgerton?
No.
There's so much to say. So it's a bunch of sisters and the second oldest, I think her name's like Eloise or something, but it's the very same thing. Like she doesn't want her older sister to get married because then she's like, I'm freaking next if you go. And so I think the internet, we've claimed her as a queer character, or like a bisexual character. Mm-hmm. She's like a little writer. She's very much a joke. She's a good little Joe prototype, scribbling her little notes, smoking cigarettes, being so edgy and whatever.
Yeah.
Anyways, but yeah, your older sister is the shield. And once that's gone, it's like, let's Danger get in. It kind of makes you think, of course, all of these characters are so angry. Even Marmee saying, I'm angry every day. I wonder, of course, there's tons to be angry about. But I kind of wonder, because especially in the movies, they made her much more explicitly feminist than she is in the book. Yeah. The Susan Sarandon was more feminist. I thought so. I kind of want to hear what's pissing Marmee off. What's she talking about with Joe?
I think you're so right. And going back to like a point you made way at the beginning, you said your partner's mom had never read Little Women, even though she's 60 and a school teacher. But that would actually put her in the demographic of people who came of age in the 70s, 80s. And at that time, Little Women, it was having a moment as the women's liberation movement and the early feminist movement took shape. Little Women became a punching bag, something that feminist writers of that time would say, this is anti-feminist. This is an example of a strong young girl having the individuality beaten out of her. It really had a moment of, it wasn't taught in school so much anymore. It had pariah status. And so Gillian Armstrong came in 1994 to direct it and really made a point of like, this is a feminist text.
It's a feminist text.
Susan Sarandon like looks directly to the camera. It's like, I think corsets are bad. As much as this book has a history, it has a real history of how it's being responded to and interpreted and in the culture. Definitely, it went through a moment where people were like, this is the antithesis of feminism. Shame on Louisa May Alcott, right?
Right. And like, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Greta Gerwig's evolution on that was, Marmee is not so much a feminist paper bag puppet who dispenses little truths. I think she pulls those threads out and talks about women's anger and really allows that to stand. We get to see Joe beating Amy's ass. Geez. Joe's really going for it, right?
Also, I don't know if you watched Downton Abbey.
No.
Okay, I love historical fiction. I watch it all. Okay.
Yes.
But yeah, so it's again a bunch of sisters, but they're wealthy. Anyway, so the mom, she has this line where she's like, raising three daughters, you think it's gonna be like Little Women, but really they're at each other's throats all the time. And I'm like, what version of Little Women did you read?
Yeah.
Because they are at each other's throats. They're not docile little girls. No. They're so creative. They're always building things and running around. I grew up in the country. And so I watched this movie, the Greta Gerwig one, for the first time on past Christmas Day. And I just like sobbed because it's very emotional. But also just this reminds me of my childhood. All these ridiculous imaginative games because we lived in the country. The internet didn't exist yet. Yeah. This is what it was like. The fighting and the making of. I grew up with four kids in my family. So that interpretation of this, you know, in Downton Abbey where they're like, oh yeah, you think it's going to be like Little Women, but it's so much worse. I'm like, Little Women is not like a sweet story of perfect children. Not at all.
Yeah. Excerpt from Little Women. Joe's hot temper mastered her and she shook Amy till her teeth chattered in her head, crying in a passion of grief and anger. Ah, it sounds pretty docile to me.
And that's like a Tuesday.
And then the moment of moral reconciliation comes as Amy is recovering from a near-death experience. And Joe says, you don't know. You can't guess how bad it is. It seems as if I could do anything when I'm in a passion. I get so savage. I could hurt anyone and enjoy it. I'm afraid I shall do something dreadful someday and spoil my life and make everyone hate me. Oh, mother, help me. Do help me. She's really in it.
Oh, yeah. And that's one of the most relatable moments for Joe for me and for lots of people, right? And I think, too, it's like this is where, again, hesitate to even say to, you know, call Joe femme in any way. But these kinds of moments, to me, that it feels very my gender. You know what I mean? Where you're just I'm supposed to be like being feminine is like this. But it's like, what do you do with all of this rage and roughness that's also comes out for me, the answer is femme, you know, like that's the answer. So yeah, so I appreciate both of the Amy and Joe just grappling with this social role, this gender role, and how they actually feel. Yes. And that's, I guess, where I see them, you know, approximating femme for me. But I definitely don't think Joe's femme.
I think Joe is as close an out literary trans character as we're going to get in a book from the 1860s, right?
Yeah.
But by the same, she does not actually get to be a boy. She doesn't get to grow up to be a man. Lou Alcott never got that either. Like, so this is a character who does have to learn to move through the world as a woman, whether she likes it or not. And it's heartbreaking, but this is one of those lessons. And I think I love what you just said about how there's so much space here to explore women's anger. And I think it's worth noting that what we get of Lori in this chapter is Lori being cool as a cucumber, incredibly calm in a crisis, not flying off the handle or freaking out, but like, yeah, okay, get a rail, go do this, this and that. And then when they're hauling Amy back home, Marmee says, I think you were so sensible in covering and getting her home quickly. And Joe says, Lori did it all. It's a moment of even a more feminine quality from Lori. There are so many moments in this book where the gender roles really get flipped. And I think this is for sure one of those moments. Yeah. I want to close on just a letter that Bronson Alcott wrote to Louisa on her 10th birthday. This is her dad. He referred to Louisa's anger and ill speakings as the worm that never dies, the gnawing worm in your breast, which chill thing to say to your 10-year-old daughter. I think it says a lot about the environment that she was growing up in and everything that she had damped down. There's a diary entry that I made particular note of from when she was a child and she was writing about learning to tame her temper. When I do this, colon, everyone loves me and I am happy. It was kind of a precondition for being loved and accepted, was learning to tame the temper down. What do you take from that about how you reckon with your own anger?
Good Lord. Yeah. So you know what, if she has notes on how she did it, I'd like I'd like that FedEx to my house immediately. Please. You know, but I think it's still, even though this book is hella old, I still think this is still a huge question. I literally talk with my therapist about it constantly. My anger has a name. I have to take her an outing so that she can see the air. She needs to get a little outing because this impossibility, I think it anyways, it's just so interesting, this idea that you have to tamp it down, you have to suppress it completely, and that's the only way that you're going to be loved and accepted. I don't think that that's really different, honestly. I don't think being angry is very popular. It's not how you make friends. And I think especially for women, it's still so hard to be angry, and it's super raced and classed. I write a lot about this in my explorations of femme, and this is why I'm really thinking about high femme camp antics as high femme, because I love thinking about femme as an effective category well as an aesthetic one. So I write a lot about low femme is where I started thinking about this, but then feeling low, not being able to, and how that impacts your presentation. Yeah. But then also, I really love the Jenny Fran Davis essay on high femme camp antics, because it's about high femme, how you look, but also this behavior. It's a behavior, right? Or it's an affect. It's a way of life, honestly. And so I think it is still really, really hard to find spaces where your anger can be accepted as part of you. And so that's why I really appreciate queer genders like femme.
Yes.
Because it creates the space where it's like, oh, we're doing high femme camp antics, and it's just it's just part of our culture. I think it is one of the ways in which we can accept, maybe get close to embracing, these ugly sides of ourselves.
For sure. Yeah. I think maybe in the same way that reading is a queer cultural practice, because it allows us to kind of vent that ugliness, but in a way where everyone's in on the joke.
Yeah.
And it's all cushioned in love, right?
Yeah. And that's the campness of it, right?
Yes.
The campness of it. We're like, I'm going to just act so out of line.
Yes. Yeah.
But with a sense of humor and with this knowledge that I know I'm not supposed to do this as a properly socialized, you know, human woman. But yeah, so I think that is the camp is the thread that holds it all together.
Yes. Yeah. Do you think Little Women is camp?
Oh, it's such a hard question, because camp is like, what is camp? I think I like know it, and then it just, I'm like, no, I've lost it all. But no, okay. I think that case, one of those things, I think for me, camp is like, I knew it when I see it. But do I think that Little Women is camp? No.
Okay.
I think, honestly, I think that the story is really quite a moral story, like religious, but I think there's a lot of room. I think in the Greta Gerwig movie, the way that she ends it with that kind of like narrative. I thought that was so cool. Anyways, I don't think that's camp exactly, but I think that there's, I don't think that it's camp. Okay. Do I think Laurie is camp and Amy is camp? Oh my gosh, is it camp? I don't know. What do you think? Is it camp?
I think specific performances, I think whatever the hell Christian Bale was doing in 94 is camp. And then I think the campiest Amy performance is actually the 1933 movie with Katharine Hepburn, which I love. It was directed by George Cukor, who was a famously out gay director. It's pre-Code, right?
Okay.
And and the actress Joan Bennett, who's playing Amy, is an adult woman who is pregnant. And like they just
that sounds amazing.
All of her costumes have to be adjusted to hide her pregnancy, right? So they're even more poofy and fluffy. And the ringlets are on point. Yeah, I think that is a very campy performance. I think
that sounds campy as well.
Combination of Joan Bennett, the actress, and George Cukor, the director, just fully bringing the camp diva out of that performance. So I would really recommend that to you and like any other Amy fan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Katharine Hepburn was also out here being like, I think I'm a, you know, I live as a man. I'm a man. Cool. So it's a nice pairing of her to that role. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Andy. Any parting words, last thoughts on this chapter?
I love it. My last thought. Yeah. I guess the thing I want to say with this chapter is, what I really appreciate about this chapter in particular is how it draws out the affective dimensions of femgender for me reading, applying a queer reading to the characters. And I think that that's really important for this story, but also for our understanding of femme. What I call femme theory more generally. So I think that it's a really, really good illustration, I think, of what do we mean when we say femme is an affective category as well as an aesthetic one. It's like, well, have you read the the chapter where Amy burns Joe's manuscript and then Joe kind of sets her up to fall in the ice? That's it.
That is high femme camp antics. All right.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. This has been such a deep conversation. I'm so, so glad you could come by. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for inviting me. This was super fun. I think we could probably talk about this for like another hour.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm really excited to hear all the other episodes and read the other work you're doing on Little Women and
thank you, et cetera. Yeah.
All right, everybody, that was Andy Schwartz. The best spot to find her online is on Instagram at acafemic, that's acafemmeic. I'm Peyton Thomas, I'm your host as always. You can find me online at peytonthomas.ca. You can also find me at a couple of fun upcoming events. I'm going to be at the Orangeville Public Library on May 17th. That's a virtual event. Come wherever you are in the world. You can also come and see me in Austin, Texas from June 1st to 5th. I'm going to be at the David Foster Wallace Conference delivering a workshop on infinite jest and fan fiction. And you can also see me at the Toronto Reference Library on June 20th, where I will be interviewing the incredible Casey McQuiston. You can find details about all of those events on peytonthomas.ca. And just a quick bit of housekeeping, we are moving to a bi-weekly schedule here at Joe's Boys Incorporated. All of these episodes are produced by just me and one other person, and we both have other full-time work, so bi-weekly was a little more doable than weekly. So thanks for listening. Tell your friends, leave a rating and a review if you enjoyed it. And I will see you all in a couple of weeks when I'll be going over Chapter 9, Meg Goes to Vanity Fair, with our incredible guest, Jaya Saxena. See you then.